things get a little bit grim. But this is especially heinous.
Did you tell the police that she was murdered, May?
Nope.
Witchy ghost stuff.
Ah! That made me scared.
A spooky girl amateur hour.
That's another fruit salad song.
Do you want to sing it for them?
No. I wouldn't. Thank you.
You're welcome.
For the offer.
I am happy to oblige.
Hi!
How's it going?
It's going good. Welcome to A Little Bit Grim. It's a podcast.
That's Jenny on that side of the couch.
That's Taylor over there.
Hi.
Hi.
We're glad you're here.
We are glad you're here. Hi, friends.
Hi, friends. There's quite a few new ones here.
We do have quite a few new friends, and we're so happy. I don't know where y'all came from.
I know. Drop us a line. Let us know where you came from.
We love you. Sorry, was that too forward with my feelings? I normally try to keep things a little more reserved than that.
We just love each and every one of you. The end.
I love you.
I love you.
I said it so heartfelt.
You did. It was cute. Was,
thank you.
Cute and genuine.
Sorry. I edit that out.
No. People can know that you're squishy.
Let me keep my emotions on the DL for real, though.
Absolutely not.
All right.
No, thanks.
Hi, welcome.
Hi.
It's you're, if you're new here, hi, you're part of a cult now.
It's cult day.
It is cult day.
Mine's a little hairy.
Oh, is it?
Yeah. Sorry.
Okay. No, don't apologize to me. I signed up. I love hairy cults.
Do ya? Gross.
The hairier, the better.
Oh, man. So I think like our benchmark cult is probably like Ant Hill Kids. That's like the worst as it's gotten.
It made me cry and gag. So, yes.
Okay. So this one doesn't have quite as much like, it's violent. There's not like a lot of heinous. I'm not going to
What episode? Hold on.
I'm not going to try to qualify it.
Pause.
It's pretty gross.
What episode was that?
Anthill?
Yeah. I feel like that was a long time ago. We were like back recording at like my old apartment.
Yeah.
An OG, if you will. It is episode 12, A False Bottom.
Oh, man.
That's an old one.
That was our second call.
Yeah. That one was gnarly. That really messed me up.
All right. So
I had big fatty tears. Is this going to make me cry? I'm not really down with that vibe today. You know, I'm just trying to keep things fun and fresh.
Are ya?
Yeah.
We picked the wrong pastime. Wrong passion project for us.
Okay.
Jenny Bear.
I just wanted a moment of peace.
You cannot have it.
Sorry.
So sorry.
I'm sorry my laugh is so annoying because I have like allergies or something happening.
Yeah,
I'm like wheezy.
I have been fighting a cold for a week now, and today's the first day I actually woke up and, like, didn't feel like I was tied to my bed, like, trying to die about it. But I slept for a million hours yesterday.
Really?
Yeah.
Good for you.
I went to sleep, and then I slept all through the night, and then I woke up at, like, 7 and was like, you know what?
No.
Nope. Went back to sleep, woke up at noon.
Wow, good for you.
Yeah.
You needed that sleep.
I did. So I am feeling a little better, but I am still just, like, a tiny bit stuffy, so I'm so sorry.
Sorry about our sinuses.
Yeah. It's gross here in Indiana.
Yeah, it always. It's muggy and like 510 degrees.
And pollen is just like floating.
Oh, it's so fucking thick. When we got back from our walk, my shoes were covered in pollen. I have black shoes. You could see them all over.
Ah, mm-hmm. So annoying. You know what else is annoying?
Huh.
This call I'm going to talk
about. Oh, okay. Sorry. Taylor getting us back right on track.
getting it right in the clutch here.
Get this train a-chugging.
So I'm going to tell you about a heinous man called Marcus Wesson.
Ew. A Marcus?
Yeah.
It's unsavory to me.
Yeah.
It gives greasy dark hair and small beady eyes.
I could see where you're going with that.
Yeah.
I can't get this man out of my head.
I'm going to Google him right now.
Yeah, I wish you would. So, he was also known as the Vampire King of Fresno.
Oh.
And my sources are the Lights Out podcast, ABC News, Wonderland of the Weird on YouTube, and the Jensen and Holes Murder Squad podcast. The cult I have for you today is about a man so evil, and yet you've probably never heard of him. His crimes were horrendous, and so many people were affected, but still he's relatively unknown. This also could have been a true crime episode, but, you know, we have to pick a bucket. And the way he lived with his family, I feel like he falls into cult land. Marcus Dellen Wesson was born August 22nd, 1946, which means that he just had his 75th birthday.
August 22nd?
He is a Leo on the cusp of a Virgo. Marcus was born in Kansas to a religious fanatic mother and an abusive alcoholic father. And thanks to Ed Gein, we know exactly how well that turns out.
It went really bad.
Not good.
It went so bad.
South.
Yes. Quickly.
Quickly.
And deeply.
Yes.
Deep south.
That's where we're at.
Okay.
Marcus was the eldest of four children, and they were raised in the Seventh-day Adventist Church. Later, the Seventh-day Adventist Church would say that he was never a member, officially.
Okay.
Marcus was a decent student, but was made fun of a lot. Most of his peers remember Marcus as a quiet boy, often fading into the background. Similarly, childhood acquaintances say that he never allowed himself to be pressured by classmates to try drugs or alcohol. Despite his size, he was a pretty big guy. He was usually more inclined to be bullied rather than bully other people himself. His peers recall that his appearance, not his academics, made him stand out. While other students dressed in jeans and t-shirts and quite casually, Wesson wore dress pants and button-up shirts with a tie to school every day.
Fancy pants.
Yeah. He was like most other kids in that he liked to play pretend. While other kids were pretending to be doctors or cowboys, Marcus pretended he was a preacher and would hold sermons to his siblings.
That's a weird path.
Yeah.
Sorry. I'm not trying to, I mean.
It's a little odd.
It's an unusual route to do, like, imaginative play.
Right. Like, if you could be anything in the world, like.
Sermoning?
Sermons.
Hmm.
So, by the early 1960s, the Wesson family had moved to San Bernardino, California. Marcus didn't have enough credits to graduate high school, but he was still allowed to participate in the graduation ceremony. Hmm. Around this time, Marcus's father left the family. He had started a sexual relationship with his own male cousin and just peaced out.
What?
Yeah.
Okay. I have to swallow that. And move forward.
Okay. While the family was hurt and betrayed, they also thought good riddance. There was a lot of talk about his father being physically and sexually abusive to the children.
Oh.
Marcus enlisted in the army and served from 1966 to 1968, where he was a medical orderly and drove an ambulance. Soon after he left the army, he met a woman named Rosemary Solario. Rosemary was 13 years older than Marcus and had 8 kids of her own by the time that they got together.
Holy mackerel.
Yeah. They moved in together. I'm not sure if they ever got legally married or not, but Marcus would have been about 22 at this point.
That's young.
Young.
So young.
Yeah.
To get married?
To have 8 kids as a steps, like, kids?
8 steps. Fuck them kids.
Listen. All right. In 1971, Rosemary gave birth to their first child together, a boy, I believe, named Adair. The timeline and the number of children gets whack. So I will do my damnedest to get all these kids' names right.
Okay.
But it's dicey.
Okay.
I said earlier that Rosemary had her own children mixed in as well. One of her daughters was a girl named Elizabeth, who would have been around 8 years old when Marcus entered her life. Marcus paid a lot of attention to Elizabeth, and because she was one of 9 kids now, attention was really hard to come by. They would play make-believe together, and he would tell her stories. She said that he was her best friend. Marcus sexually abused Elizabeth, and he told her that she was his wife.
Oh, Jesus.
I am sorry. It's just not going to get very much better.
God.
When she turned 15, he legally married her.
Huh? What about his wife?
I don't think that they ever got married.
Okay.
I think he just moved in with her, had a baby with her.
Okay.
And then...
just playing house.
Yeah. Turned his sights on Elizabeth.
That is so fucked.
It's bad. It's fucked up. Elizabeth says that Marcus brought her with him to talk to her mother, and he said, "We are in love. I want to marry your daughter." Elizabeth thought her mom would be furious that she had stolen her man, but Rosemary's eyes filled with tears, and she said, "I'm just so happy for you," and gave her written permission.
What?
Which is just gut-wrenching.
What in the hell is going on here?
Some bullshit. That's what's happening.
That is some bullshit.
Absolutely. Like, what kind of a mother does that? What kind?
To your man?
What?
Especially, her and Marcus were, like...
Together.
Were doodaddling, right?
Uh-huh.
And then he wants to doodaddle with her daughter.
Uh-huh.
And she was like, oh,
I'm happy for you.
Oh, I'm so glad you found peace and happiness. Like, what?
I just boggled.
Okay.
Mind
boggled. I don't. Okay.
You should not be able to get married before you can drive a car.
Period.
There's a lot of things you should not be able to get married before you can do, but...
There's no cap.
Yeah.
I don't think you should be able to get married before you're of legal drinking age.
I would agree with that. I would.
Me.
Okay. Later, Elizabeth said that she believed anything that he said at the time. He was very convincing and said that God had chosen her and that she was special. Marcus and Elizabeth lived on the first floor of the house while Rosemary lived on the second floor with her 8 kids. Eventually, they decided that they needed their own space, and Marcus told Rosemary that he wanted the van when they moved. She refused, but he said he would either take the van or their son Adair.
Oh.
Marcus and Elizabeth ended up taking the van and leaving Adair behind.
Okay.
Elizabeth endured terrible sexual violence and abuse for years, and by the time that she was in her mid-20s, she had given birth 11 times.
What?
Yes.
10 years?
She was in her mid-20s. So she, I think she was 26. I think she was 26.
So she had 8 kids. How many kids?
She had 11.
11 kids!
Yeah. She was constantly pregnant.
Oh my God.
Yeah. 2 of the 11 died in childbirth. And then Elizabeth's sister, who was also named Rosemary, so this is like another Rosemary in the story, got into trouble with drugs and sent her kids to live with Marcus and Elizabeth. There were a number of nieces and nephews aging between 5 and 11 years old. The children in that situation had been abused in their home growing up and were excited to go live with Elizabeth and Marcus, believing that they would be safer there. The total number of people in the household at this point would be between 16 and 18.
What? Do they live in a mansion? I imagine not.
No. No? Mm-mm. Sure didn't.
Okay.
Marcus would go on to quote-unquote marry and have children with 3 of his nieces, Ruby Ortiz, Rosa Solario, and Safina Solario. These marriages were in addition to those with 2 of his own daughters. So he was legally married to Elizabeth because her mother gave her written permission, mm-hmm. and the other marriages were like the polygamist, like,
oh God. Marriage before God.
Marriage ceremonies. But he had incestuous relationships with every single one of them.
That is so fucking foul.
Horrifying.
Is this man still alive?
Yes.
That's a bummer.
Yeah. Marcus was violent and evil, and he beat the children regularly. It would only get worse if they moved or cried during the beatings. Marcus could not keep a steady job, and most of his income came from welfare. Mm. The family drifted from place to place, and some of the places the family found themselves in were quite strange. At one time, the family lived in a 26-foot boat moored in Santa Cruz Harbor. In the mid to late 90s, the family lived together in a trailer and a large army tent in the Santa Cruz Mountains.
What?
On land with no running water.
Oh.
The Wessons also lived for a time in a decaying 63-foot tugboat off the shore of Marin County, California. And sometimes they lived in a school bus.
That's a lot of people.
Yeah. In such a tight quarters.
Oh my God.
Over the years, Marcus had owned several boats, all in various states of disrepair. It was one of these rundown boats that would draw attention from authorities. It was discovered that Marcus hadn't claimed the boat while receiving government benefits, and he was charged with welfare fraud. Mm. The city stated that he had failed to list the vessel as an asset, defrauding the government of almost $25,000. Had the boat been listed as the family's primary residence, it wouldn't have been considered an asset, but it was too late for Marcus to attempt to claim it as their residence. He wrote to the judge, who was asked to preside over the case, a number of letters totaling nearly 80 pages.
Oh my God.
In his ramblings, Marcus stated that not only was he aware of being investigated, but he himself was investigating the IRS.
Were you?
Right.
Okay.
Delusional. Obviously, he was not all mentally there, but at this point, the authorities didn't know of anything else going on. Right. So they weren't, like, concerned about everything that they should have been concerned about.
Sure.
By the late 1990s, a few of the children were old enough to work, and Marcus used their money to buy a building. And the building was an old retail store.
Okay.
None of the children went to school. Marcus, of course, taught them himself with flashcards, textbooks he found, and his own handwritten Bible.
Oh, yikes.
Of course, he was a religious fanatic and had a very interesting take on Christianity. He twisted the scriptures of the Bible to reflect his own strange beliefs. The isolation the children experienced kept them from questioning their existence, and they thought that everything they were enduring was completely normal. In the 1990s, Marcus and the family were watching as the Branch Davidian siege took place with bated breath. Marcus was obsessed with David Koresh and decided to make his family a reflection of Koresh's family.
Oh, God.
He agreed with Koresh that the people on the outside world were eventually going to come in and take away his family, so he taught them that anyone in uniform was an enemy. He also believed that, like Koresh, he was making children to make up an army of God.
Oh, yikes.
Also, like Koresh, he believed that he was a deity, specifically the Son of God. He spent a ton of time reading the Bible and his own handwritten Bible. He would say, if you've seen God or if you've seen Jesus Christ, you have seen me. The children truly believed that he was God, and they did their best to obey him. But even the smallest infraction would trigger his rage. If they asked for anything, all they could do, at all, they could be punished. One of the boys told ABC News that there was a 30-day punishment where the children would get struck 21 times in the morning, 21 times in the afternoon, and 21 times at night for 30 days straight.
Why?
One example was that one of the boys asked for a spoonful of peanut butter.
I'm so sorry.
They weren't allowed to ask for anything. It was horrible. One of the girls said that the expectation was that the children would have to remind him to give them their punishments.
What?
And if you forgot to remind him of your punishments, it just got worse. Horrible.
I'm nauseated.
Yeah. He had a strange belief system that does not jive with modern Christianity, and he believed that Jesus saved the people with his blood. We are told to drink the blood of Jesus during communion.
It's so witchy.
The only explanation for this was that Jesus must have been a vampire.
What?
Mm-hmm. So he believed.
Okay.
That Jesus was a vampire.
Sure.
And thus he was a vampire.
Ah, yes.
Okay.
Sure.
He believed that he and his family were like vampires, but different because they had souls, where vampires were prevented from moving around in the daylight because they were soulless. Now, before anybody gets twisted, I don't believe there is any cannibalism or drinking blood in this story, but it does shed light on why he wanted so many children so his blood could carry on.
Okay.
He even gave one of his daughters the name of Jiva, which is the combo of Jesus and vampire. But the best part is that he also gave himself a vampire name.
Oh, good. I hope, is it, hold on.
Uh-huh.
Is it something stupid?
Yes.
Is it like Antoine?
No.
Or like, hold on. What's his, what? From Anne Rice, Interview with a Vampire.
Oh, God.
Lafayette. No.
This True Blood.
Different one. Oh, my gosh. This is so embarrassing.
I know who you're talking about. I just can't remember his name.
Lestat.
Yeah. There no. It is not. It is G. Van Marcus Pyre. G's Jesus.
Uh-huh.
Van Marcus Pyre. Vampire.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Uh-huh. So that was his name.
Okay.
Cool. Are we
I
all
I think on... my options were better.
I agree.
But nobody asked.
No. So, good old Marcus Pyre.
Marcus Pyre. Okay.
Oh, God. Marcus had Bible study for hours every single day, teaching his whack-ass doctrine to all of his million children, and seemed to pick and choose different aspects from cults they had heard of and blended them all into his own family. He took the child sexual abuse from Children of God, the endless preaching in government is the enemy rhetoric from David Koresh, and polygamous marriage from the fundamentalist Mormons. As the children grew up and were able to work, he would send them out to get jobs and then would confiscate their earnings. They never got to keep any of it. Marcus would go out and get fast food and eat really well, and then the kids had to scrounge around for dumpsters for food.
Ugh.
One day, when Elizabeth's oldest daughter, Kiani, was 18, she came to Elizabeth and told her that she was pregnant. Elizabeth asked who the father was, and she never because she had never heard of any boyfriend being around. When Kiani refused to answer, she realized the horrible truth, that it was her husband's baby. A few years prior, Elizabeth had gone to Marcus and told him that she didn't want to have any more children, and he was surprisingly easygoing about it, which made her very suspicious, mm-hmm. but she didn't press it. She realized now that it was just that he didn't need her to have babies anymore. There are a house full of women that he could have children with.
Oh my God, it's disgusting.
Yeah. Marcus believed that through incest, he could make the perfect seed of himself.
Literally, science says no.
Literally.
There's no, literally no way that can happen.
Actually, the opposite.
You're gonna have a Habsburg chin on your hands.
We are doing damage.
It's not it.
It is very much contested now as to how much Elizabeth knew about Marcus abusing the other girls. Elizabeth says she doesn't know anything and never asked who the father was of any of the other babies because she said that if they wanted her to know, they would have told her. However, later it would come out that she had walked in on sexual abuse multiple times and clearly knew what was happening.
Oh, Elizabeth.
I know. She was 8 when all of this started, though.
I know.
Like, it's hard to, I mean,
she
not
was
to,
groomed
like,
her entire life.
Right. It's such a hard situation. Like, I think she knew what was happening, but I think that
she's powerless in doing anything to stop it.
Right. Like, her entire belief system was
this
garbage human, what he told her. He was also really controlling about how the boys and girls interacted with each other in the house. The boys were not allowed to talk to the girls at all. He was afraid that they would start chasing after the girls and ruin his perfect bloodline.
Well,
if one of the boys asked about the pregnancies, the girls were instructed to say that they were impregnated by artificial insemination.
What?
In addition, the girls were not allowed to talk to their mother. And it seemed that even with so many people living in the house, secrets were well kept.
Wow.
In all, Marcus had incestuous relationships with his daughter Kiani and Sabrina and his niece Rosa and Ruby. By the time Ruby was 13, he had told her that God wanted him to have more than one wife and it was time for them to get married and it would be time for her to start having children. She ended up having a boy named Aviv. At one point, 4 or 5 of the girls were pregnant at one time. Because Elizabeth had gotten her tubes tied all those years ago, Marcus had told the girls that they were surrogates because Elizabeth was no longer able to have children. He also took something from Jonestown. He had created a suicide pact with his family and told them that if the police came to get them and tear their family apart, that they would have to kill themselves.
Oh my God.
He would remain behind to tell the world of their decision. So everybody's got to die.
You all die. I will not.
Yeah.
You die, though.
Yeah.
I can't. I think you should.
Yeah.
Consider
but, like,
this.
Me.
But for me.
Somebody's got to be in front of the cameras to tell them why we did this.
Why you did.
What you did.
What you should do.
Uh-huh.
But not me, though.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. He held monthly meetings to discuss details to make sure that everyone knew what to do.
Suicide drills?
Yep.
Is that really what we're...
That's what we're doing.
Okay.
Yeah. Eventually, Marcus's nieces, Sophina and Ruby, wanted to leave the family, and he told them that they could go, but they would have to leave their boys behind, and when they were old enough, he would let them have the boys. While they didn't love that, they also didn't want to lose the opportunity to leave.
Mm-hmm.
So, on March 12th, 2004, the women returned to the house to demand custody of the boys now that they had reached the age that Marcus agreed to release them by.
Mm.
Ruby, Sophina, and a few other family members had come to the house, and Marcus refused to let the boys out. Some of his nieces and daughters had stayed and went to the yard yelling at Ruby and Safina that they were bitches and Judas, and they were cursing them, saying, like, come in and bow down to your master, all this
wild Jezebels.
Stuff. Yes. Eventually, the neighbors called the Fresno police at 2:15 p.m. The Fresno police arrived believing that this would be another domestic dispute, and oh boy, were they wrong.
Was it not?
Was it not that? For about an hour, the police interview Ruby, Sophina, and Marcus. Marcus was standing in the doorway of the home, cool, calm, and collected, but would not let the police in.
Okay.
The police were told that they did not have cause to enter the home. Marcus decides that he's had enough of this and goes into the home and locks the door. The police yell for him to come out and talk, but he does not answer. Two women rush out of the home and say that Marcus has a gun. The officers call for SWAT at 3:45 p.m., and it takes an hour for SWAT to get there and surround the home. Neighbors recall hearing gunshots, although the police report that the officers did not hear it. On Jensen and Hull's murder squad, they talked about this, and they said that the likelihood of an officer not hearing a gunshot when multiple civilians did is very unlikely.
Yeah.
At 4:47 p.m., Marcus emerges from the home covered in blood. He surrendered to the police willingly. He was arrested for suspicion of homicide, and they set his bail at $9 million. When the officers went into the home, they found a scene out of a horror movie. All seven children were in the back room of the home. They had all been shot point blank in the eye. Marcus had stacked them one on top of the other. At first, they didn't even know how many bodies there were because it just seemed like a tangled mass. The victims were Sabrina April Wesson, age 25, Elizabeth Brianna Kina Wesson, age 17, Illabel Carey Wesson, age 8, Aviv Dominic Wesson, age 7.
I love the name Aviv.
Yeah, me too. Jonathan St. Charles Wesson, age 7, Ethan St. Laurent Wesson, age 4, Marshy St. Christopher Wesson, age 1, Jeeva St. Vlad's Vinsbury Wesson, age 1, and Sedona Vadra Wesson, age 1. As the trial started, many of Marcus's sons and daughters refused to say anything bad about him. They had clearly been brainwashed their entire lives, and just because he was behind bars, that did not break the spell they were under.
Oh my God.
Marcus tried to pin the murder on the oldest victim, his daughter Sabrina. He said that she's the one that pulled the trigger, but the jury did not care who fired the fatal shots and convicted him of murder anyway, presumably finding that he had persuaded his children to enter into a suicide pact. Wesson was convicted of 9 counts of first-degree murder on June 17, 2005, and was also found guilty on 14 counts of forcible rape and the sexual molestation of 7 of his daughters and nieces. Wesson was sentenced to death on June 27, 2005, and is currently still on death row in San Quentin State
Prison. Wow.
That is the Vampire King of Fresno.
That was fucking awful, Taylor. Like, you did a good job telling me the story.
Of how horrible it was.
The story was terrible.
Yes, it was. Yeah. And there's another part in here. I didn't really know where to, like, put it because it doesn't really
fit.
But at some point, he bought 10 coffins.
Huh?
Like, oversized coffins.
They're so expensive.
Right. He bought them from, like, an antique shop or something. I don't know where he bought them, but he told the owner that he was going to use the wood to, like, patch up one of his boats.
Okay.
But they ended up just being stacked in their house that, like, this final, like, act was in. And so there's so many pictures of, like, people, like, pulling coffins out of the house. And... what? Like, it's just wild. I don't know why he had them, but he had 10 coffins in his house.
That's not a really great investment.
No. Deep breath, everybody.
I need a breather.
Whew.
Oh, my lord.
Yeah, I had to reel myself in on that one, too, even though it was kind of long. Like, there was still a lot that All right, what kind of terrible shit are you going to tell me?
Oh, you know what? I'm so glad you asked. Because I am, in fact, going to tell you also terrible shit. We're not giving you guys any relief in this episode.
Oh.
You're getting none.
It's a darken.
Mine's a darken. Mine is this. The cult is a wordy one.
Mm.
And I'm not saying, like, go out and start a cult and find a cute name. I'm saying if you start a cult, have a name that is not the Movement for the Restoration of the Ten Commandments of God, which is what?
Wordy.
Wordy!
Naming conventions are important.
Yes, they really are.
Gotta have something memorable and easy to say.
You need to be able to, like, either abbreviate it.
Make it an acronym.
An acronym is always really good. This one is not good.
Okay.
You know, we're starting weak from the foundation.
I've, like, heard of this just by title, but I don't know anything about them. So I'm excited for you to tell me.
It's pretty gnarly, honestly. Yeah. Sources are Wikipedia. There's an article titled The Preacher and the Prostitute, which was published March of 2000 from BBC World News. An article, Uganda's Cult, Mystique Finally Turned Deadly by Ian Fisher, April 2000, New York Times, and Evidence Indicates Uganda Cult Held an Eerie Prelude by Henry E. Coven of the New York Times.
Okay.
So, I know we like to muse over how people get wrapped up into cults, especially when we're talking about the ones with extreme wackadoo beliefs or aliens or what we just covered.
Yeah.
Like, what have you. And to be honest, I think in all of our, like, uneducated musing, we really gloss over, like, the socioeconomic, political, and cultural reasons why people can become vulnerable enough to be manipulated and goaded into extremism. However, the Movement for the Restoration of the Ten Commandments for God had a perfect storm to get people into their flock.
Mm.
We have a reason for this one.
Interesting.
The recent past of Uganda had been marked with political and social turmoil. The rule of Idi Amin, the AIDS pandemic, and the Ugandan Bush War wreaked havoc across the country. People became pessimistic and fatalistic, and their faith in the Roman Catholic Church, which was well established, was quickly backsliding, enveloped in scandals, and the faithful were becoming dissatisfied. In this void, many post-Catholic groups formed in the late 80s as a confused and traumatized populace turned to charismatic, self-declared messiahs who renounced the authority of the government and the church. An example of this phenomenon was a Christian resistance group, the Holy Spirit Movement, which fought against the government of Yoweri Museveni, a former member of Paul Ikazire. Would explain his motivation to join the Movement for the Restoration of the Ten Commandments of God. And he said, quote, "We joined the movement as a protest against the Catholic Church. We had good intentions. The church was backsliding and priests were covered in scandals and the AIDS scourge was taking its toll on the faithful. The world seemed poised to end." I would like to mention that Yoweri was a member of the same organization under a different sect. So that's why he was able to speak on it and was not part of what actually happened with this sect that I'm going to cover. The Movement for the Restoration of the Ten Commandments of God was a religious movement founded by Credonia and Joseph Kibwatire in southwestern Uganda. It was formed in the late 1980s, and its five primary leaders were Joseph Credonia and a Joseph Kasupurari, John Kamagara, which is Credonia's father, and Dominic Kataribabo.
Okay.
The earliest origins of the movement have been traced back to Credonia Merwende's father, Paolo Kashaku. I lied to you.
Hmm.
Joseph, can I back up?
Mm-hmm.
Can you delete all of that?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, thanks.
Just couch messing you up.
I just need a moment. Hello.
We're having a time.
Something just happened
over here,
and we're trying to
Jesus.
And we're just gonna go ahead and breeze right past it.
Oh my gosh. Jenny completely lost her own place in her story. We got up. We had like a little sparkling water break. I tripped over my cord. I knocked water all over the place.
Ripped the microphone off the stand.
We're just really not doing good.
But you know what?
Today.
We're back with sparkling water and Pedialyte.
Jenny's whole butt is wet.
My butt is wet, but we're moving past it.
I'm so sorry.
It's okay. Do you want to know who the five primary founders of this cult were?
Yes, I would love to know.
Well, let me tell ya. It was Joseph Kibwitiri, Joseph Kadapurari, John Kamagara, Dominic Kataribabo, and Credonia Merwende. The earliest origins of the movement have been traced back to Credonia's father, Paolo Kashaku. In 1960, he claimed to have had a vision of his deceased daughter, Evangelista, who told him that he would have visions of heaven.
Okay.
The prediction came to pass in 1988 when he saw Jesus Christ, the Virgin Mary, and Saint Joseph. And I would like to state that this was 28 years later. 28 years later.
After she said you're going to have visions of...
After he had a vision of his deceased daughter who told him that he would see Jesus. 28 years later.
That's a long time.
Well, that's... Listen, this is why I am not an oracle. Because if the universe gave me a vision and expected me to retain that information for another 28 years...
It's not going to happen.
It's not going to happen.
No.
You have 24 to 48 business hours.
Yeah.
For, like, that to come to pass.
Also, the, like, my curious nature and impatient, like, heart that I have...
Couldn't live.
Could never. I would immediately, like, a week goes by, I'd be like, well, that's not happening.
No. Or I would think everybody is Jesus.
Oh, that too.
Every stranger on a bus, every person who looks at you a little too long in a subway.
Oh, too many people.
Too many people. They're all Jesus. I could never. Anyway, so Credonia also had similar visions and was involved in a virgin cult.
Oh, no.
Now, for what it's worth, I also found in my research, it was mentioned that Credonia was also a sex worker, which is fine. I just don't see the lifestyle, like, jiving with virgin cult.
Yeah.
And I wasn't able to find any information on, like, the name of the cult or the sect or what her role was. Within that was.
Interesting.
Yeah. So, in 1989, Credonia's dad instructed Credonia to spread the message across Uganda on the orders of the Virgin Mary. In that year, she would meet Joseph Kibwitiri. Mr. Kibwitiri first announced the Virgin Mary had appeared to him in 1984, which was 4 years before Credonia's dad finally had his vision.
Sure. Okay.
So, like, in the same 5 years of time, this all three of these people are just having visions. Of all kinds just of stuff.
Having so much enlightenment.
So, they're just... doing a great job of following their dreams.
Seeing things.
Uh-huh. They're doing a great job of hallucinating.
Yeah, great.
Okay. His convictions were strengthened when a few years later he ran into old dirty dog Credonia spouting off about how she had said that she had just got done seeing the Virgin Mary in a cave near Joseph Kibwitiri's home. She was like, oh my God, that's so ironic. Like, I just talked to her in this cave down here.
Weird.
That's so crazy. We're, like, meant to be together.
What a coincidence.
So strange. And they were. Joseph Kibwitiri's son, Rugambwa, reported in an interview with the Sunday Times that Credonia moved in soon afterward. And the next thing we knew, she was in our house and they had decided to start their cult there. Soon, she was beating us all. My father was in awe of her and would do anything she said.
Ooh.
Indeed.
I think we should question it if you're willing to do whatever anybody else says.
I have never had blind
faith
in anyone, and rightfully so, no one has ever put blind faith in me.
That's fair.
Which was a good choice for them.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't.
Not built that way.
Not built that way. But a lot of people are.
Yeah. That's... question everything, y'all.
Ask questions. All of them.
Be a brat. Do it.
Get into a dom kink.
Yeah.
Be a brat.
Be a brat. Say
piss
no.
Piss off your dom. Say, make me. And what are you going to do if I don't? Or what?
Or what?
Or what? The sect, anyway.
Sorry.
The sect grew in importance with the arrival of Dominic Kattari Babo, who was a respected and popular priest with a PhD from a university in the United States.
Hmm.
In order to obtain more funds for the increasing number of disciples, Kibwetiri sold three of his properties, a car, and a milling machine. And by the late 1990s, the church had grown into a thriving community set in pineapple and banana plantations.
Fun!
I know, which sounds beautiful. Except the shit went sideways.
Oh.
Members lived communally on land bought by pooling their assets, which they had sold when they joined the movement. Credonia claimed to receive messages from the Virgin Mary through a hidden telephone system that communicated through everyday mundane objects such as cups and plates.
Hmm.
So, whatever.
All right.
You got that T-Mobile China.
Uh-huh.
That's cool.
Yeah.
She said to have persuaded her husband, Joe, like I know him.
Joe.
Old Joe. Her old man, Joe, she persuaded to take his children out of school and to sell his remaining assets and properties.
Okay.
And also said that the Virgin Mary told her to kill all children under 5.
Oh.
And a sacrifice was needed immediately. And this was corroborated by their daughter, Edith. It was like, oh, yeah, she did. She told all kids under 5 needed to be killed. And there needed to be a sacrifice immediately.
Horrible.
Wild. The cult in Western Uganda built houses for recruitment, indoctrination, and worship, and also a primary school. The year 2000 was decided to be the final compelling date for the sect's predictions of the apocalypse.
Okay.
We've got an apocalypse cult.
Okay.
On our hands.
A sex apocalypse cult.
The sect.
Oh, the okay. Sect. Got it. I was like, what?
Not sex. Can you imagine? A sex apocalypse cult. I'm starting that, dibs.
Dibs. TM.
TM. Nobody steal my cult. This was not the first date that they had predicted.
Oh, okay. However, did the other one come and go and nothing happened?
Oh, there were many.
Oh, no.
There were many.
All right.
The group had become a little notorious for predicting dates, and gosh dang it, wouldn't you know, the heckin' world just kept turning.
Dang it.
Followers, following each failed prediction, the members would ask for their money and possessions to be, like, returned to them, because they're like, come on. Like, you convinced me to sell all of my shit to you and give you all of my cash because you said the world was ending and nothing happened.
So now I need it back.
I would like my money back, please. And they said no.
Uh-huh. Weird.
No. We just did the math wrong. It's the wrong day. The world is ending.
The world is indeed ending, not today.
No, listen, God's math and my math are just not the
different
same.
Things.
Different maths. So, the members would ask for their shit to be returned, and they were obviously
denied.
And they were not happy about it, and it created some upset within the community. Life in the sect was no picnic.
Okay.
The group took their commitment to the Ten Commandments to such a devout and insane level that the group was discouraged from even speaking out of fear for breaking the Ninth Commandment, "Thou shalt not bear false witness against thy neighbor." The cult spent numerous days without using their voices, in silence, communicating only through sign language. There was also strict fasting, and they only ate one meal every 2 days. They're forbidden from using soap, socializing, or having sex, which would definitely be, like, all of that would be, one, I can't keep my mouth shut to save my fucking life.
Same.
I'm not.
The end.
I would like to use soap. Uh-huh. I would like to speak.
Uh-huh.
And sex is a bonus.
Yeah.
Why?
Lots of fun.
Lots of all the fun things you took from me.
Why we didn't make very good Christians.
Talking about soap and sex. So stupid.
They're just like, oh God. Okay. All right. So just standing around, not talking to each other.
In silence.
Dirty.
Hungry.
Oh.
Smelly.
I would be unpleasant.
Like, I'm not saying if I ever do get drawn in
uh-huh,
to a cult, if it is like one of those no sex cults, that would be my like red flag. Not for anything, but because I know that that's a group of grumpy, mean ass people.
Yep.
And I am just not trying to
tangle with all that.
I don't want that vibe like in my circle.
Right. I think if you ever text me and you're like, I'm going to join a sexless cult, that's when I'll know that you've been kidnapped.
Yes. That can be our tag.
That'll be the like 911 flag. Yeah.
You have to go to the police and be like, she said she didn't want to have sex in a cult anymore.
It's like indoorsy people being like, I'm going for a hike.
No, we're
like,
not.
No, you're not. No. Calling bullshit on
just
that.
Just because you put on sneakers and biker shorts means nothing. Carol.
Me. Me.
Me at myself.
Yes.
Oh, anyway. Sorry. So sidetracked.
Just squirrely.
Squirrely. Squirrely all over today. Things were tumultuous, and in 1992, the group was ordered out of the, I'm so sorry, Ruwashamere village where they lived by the elders. They were kicked out. They were like, this shit is too much. Ooh. You gotta go find somewhere else.
All right.
So they did. They moved to the Kanungu district, where Credonia's father offered an extensive property for their use. In 1994, Paul Ikazire left the sect, taking with him approximately 70 members.
Okay.
By 1997, according to a filing with the government, the movement's membership was listed at nearly 5,000 people. It's a lot of people not using soap. In 1998, the Ugandan press reported that the movement had been shut down for unsanitary conditions, use of child labor, possibly kidnapping children, but then the sect was allowed to reopen by the government. So close to doing good. And with the new year looming, activity by movement members became frenzied.
Okay.
Their leaders urged them to confess their sins in preparation for the end. Clothes and cattle were sold cheaply. Past members were re-recruited and all work in the field ceased. January 1st, 2000, passed without the advent of the apocalypse yet again, and the movement began to unravel. Questions were asked of Mwende and Kibwetire, and payments to the church decreased dramatically. Ugandan police believed that some members who had been required to sell their possessions and turn over the money to the movement rebelled and demanded the return of their money yet again. It is believed that events that followed were orchestrated by sect leaders in response to the crisis within the rank.
Okay.
Another date was immediately predicted. March 17th, 2000 was the new end of the world, a doomsday that they said would come with ceremony and finality.
St. Patrick's Day.
St. Patrick's Day. According to the New York Times, the movement held a huge party at Kanungu where they roasted 3 bowls and drank 70 crates of soda.
What?
70 crates of soda.
That is a lot.
So much soda.
How many people were there?
A lot.
Okay. All right. 70 crates of soda.
So it's still a lot for 70 crates of soda.
All right.
Minutes after the members arrived at the party, nearby villagers heard an explosion, and the building was gutted, and an intense fire killed all 530 in attendance.
Oh my god.
Including dozens of children. The windows and doors of the building had been boarded up to prevent people from leaving. The fire alerted the Ugandan authorities to what had been occurring in the movement several days, for the past several days. Before this, the movement leader, Dominic Katirababo, had been seen buying 50 liters of sulfuric acid, which may have been what started the fire. Another party was planned for the 18th, just the day right after, which officials believe sect leaders had announced in order to mislead authorities as to their plans. The 5 principal cult leaders, Joseph Casapurari, John Kamigara, Dominic Katirababo, and Credonia Mwende were assumed to have died in the fire.
Uh-huh.
4 days after the church fire, police investigated movement properties and discovered hundreds of bodies at sites across southern Uganda.
Oh my god.
6 bodies were discovered sealed in the latrine of the Kanungu compound, as well as 153 bodies at a compound in Buhuange. 153 bodies at Dominic Katirababo's estate, where they had been all either poisoned or stabbed.
Jesus.
And another 81 bodies lay at Leader Joseph near Miranda's farm.
We're like 400 bodies.
Oh, more than, there were 530 in attendance at the original fire.
Right, but like so, the bodies that they're finding, right? Yeah. It's like almost at 400.
I think the total is like 931.
Holy shit.
Or something.
That is so many people. Yeah.
Police stated that these bodies that they found after had been murdered about 3 weeks prior to the fire.
Wow.
Other than the individuals who died in the fire, medical examiners determined that the majority of the dead sect members had been poisoned. Early reports suggested that they had been strangled based on the presence of twisted banana fibers around their necks. After searching all sites, police concluded that earlier estimates of nearly 1,000 dead had been exaggerated. Even though the final death toll had settled at 924.
924. Woof.
It's a lot of people. After interviews and an investigation were conducted, the police ruled out a cult suicide and instead consider it to be a mass murder conducted by movement leadership. They believe that the failure of the doomsday prophecy led to a revolt in the ranks of the sect and the leaders as they set the new day, and then it came and passed. The people were upset, so they created this new date to get all of their sect followers in one place.
And then killed them all.
And all the people who they knew would not be there, they killed prior.
Wow.
Witnesses said that the movement leadership had never spoken of mass suicide when preparing members for the end of the world. A survivor recalled meeting a devout member of the cult with nails and a hammer on his way after he had left. It is believed he is the one who shut the windows with nails to prevent anyone from escaping. The Ugandan government responded with condemnation. The president, Yoweri Museveni, called the event a mass murder by these priests for monetary gain. The vice president said that these were callously well-orchestrated mass murders perpetrated by a network of diabolic, malevolent criminals masquerading as religious leaders. Although it was initially assumed that the five leaders died in the fire, police now believe that Joseph Kibutire and Credonia Morende may still be alive and have issued an international warrant for their arrest.
Ooh.
In 2014, it was announced by the Uganda National Police that there were reports that Kibutire was hiding in Malawi, but nothing solid has ever came from that. Maybe we'll have an update for you later. But as of right now, that's really all we know about the leadership. There was a claim from a teenage survivor of the fire that swears upon God that he saw Credonia running away from the flames through the field. But one of her children swears that he saw her burn body in with the remains of the other followers.
So we may never know.
We may never know. It's quite possible we may never know. But that is the story of the movement for the restoration of the Ten Commandments of God.
That's a wild one.
That's crazy.
Jeez.
Super gross.
Ew.
Ick indeed.
Well, gross ones today.
Don't join a cult.
Don't do it.
They're so rarely good. You know what I mean?
Right. And those are the ones we don't hear about.
Right. Well, are they? Or are there, like, worse ones that we don't hear about because, like, their leaders are, like, better and more organized and
more good at being a culty?
More, they're a bigger, cultier cult. And so we never...
The Big Daddy cult.
Big Daddy cult.
Big Boss Bowser cult.
Big Boss Bowser. Big Bad Boys.
Yeah.
So yeah, who knows? I don't know.
Wow.
I just think, stay away from people who are too charismatic.
Yeah. You need... Stay away from people who try to tell you what to do.
Mm-hmm.
You know? That's just not a good idea.
I think it's always in your best interest to just do whatever the fuck you want to do.
Question everything.
Question everything. And try not to, like, recruit people. I think recruitment is such a weird take.
Yeah. Do you think that they think of it as recruitment? Or do you think that they just think of it as, like, a gathering of people?
I think it depends. I think it's recruitment if you're something like Nexium, where you're using people's, like, actual assets.
Uh-huh.
But if you're more of, like, a deranged type of cult leader and you're just looking for more people to follow you, like, more adoration.
Uh-huh. I don't know if I can call it recruitment, you know?
Yeah, I'm not sure I would call that recruitment.
Weird.
It's It's more like mental kidnapping.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Psychological warfare.
Yeah. It's not it.
Mm-mm.
Gross. Anyway, thanks for listening.
Yeah. Do you have a bright and shiny today?
My bright and shiny is that I accidentally bought concert tickets.
I don't think this is an accident.
Well, I wanted to do it. And I texted Taylor and I was like, hey, come to this concert with me. But I was like, well, I thought that I was like, no, better not. This is after. Okay, listen, I'm just going to be very honest with you. I don't really drink alcohol. Okay. But uh-huh. I made a seared steak with a beurre blanc sauce and I had like a bottle. I only used like a quarter a cup and sure. I had a nice bottle of Chardonnay. And you know what? If I didn't drink that whole heckin' thing and see that Greta Van Fleet was playing in Chicago and I was like, boy, do I want to go to that?
Uh-huh.
I bought the tickets. I saw it come out of my bank account. So, but I've turned this into a positive situation.
Uh-huh.
I am so excited to go. I love Greta Van Fleet more than anything.
Yeah.
In my whole life. See, now I'm nervous sweating. Maybe this isn't a bright and shiny. Maybe this is a point of anxiety.
Okay. Do you want to tell them how much you spent on these tickets?
Nope, I don't want okay. to. Thank you.
See, the only thing that I got out of this conversation was I went to bed very early because I was suffering from a massive head cold. What are you doing on this day? I want to do a thing.
No questions asked.
Never mind. I lied. So the next morning I woke up and I was like, wait, what? What are we doing? What did you lie about? And you were like, concert. Decided not to go. And then we show up today. We're like, by the way, I'm going. And I'm like, wait, what?
Well, because I was talking and this is my fault. I had a friend, Jaime, was uh-huh. over chilling with me.
Okay.
And we were just like bullshitting and we were talking. I made her listen to like 4 Greta Van Fleet songs. Poor Jaime, who had no interest.
She was probably like, whatever, dude.
Literally. Anyway, and I was like, oh my God, I should buy him. She's like, you should buy him. And I was like, I don't know, maybe am I going to buy him? And she was like, I don't know, are you? And I was like, I don't know. I did. But I didn't know that I did until like 3 days after the fact.
Oh, got it.
I still haven't got the tickets. So you know what? Maybe I'm not going.
Where'd you buy him from?
Some place I've never fucking heard of. Hold on, I'll tell you.
Oh, God. Jenny.
I know. I was not doing, hold on, I'll show you. I got it from, no matches. Listen, I really could not be going. Seat popper, seat, I don't know.
Okay.
I'll get it. It's fine. Uh-huh. They said they'll send me the tickets the day before the concert, so I have, like, 4 days until that.
The day before?
Yeah.
That's terrifying.
Yeah. Well, there's, like, a little bit of money on the line for this.
So stupid. Can I pick a different bright and shiny? This is not my bright and shiny.
Yes. Donut was extra snuggly this morning, and that's my bright and shiny.
Aw, cute donut.
Oh, my God.
I can't wait to hear about this, how it turns out, and all your money dollars.
Listen, it was stupid. Maybe I'll have the time of my life.
Yeah.
Maybe I'll meet the tiny music elf himself. I don't know. We'll see.
You know, this would serve you right, because you're going to stay at the Congress Plaza again without me, which is just so rude.
Well, come to Chicago with me!
With what money? With what?
I'm gonna go home.
You just don't like me getting yelled at.
That's why I want to go home.
No!
Nobody yells at me there.
They should.
I know they do. Jesus. All the time.
Oh my gosh.
Ian, Donut, and Theo.
Oh my gosh, getting yelled at left, right, and center.
Seriously.
Oh man.
I'm battered. Anyway, what's your bright and shiny?
Let's see. What is my bright and shiny? Oh, when this comes out, my brother gets married tomorrow.
Oh,
yeah.
Hey, Aaron.
Yeah, wait, no. That was last week. This week.
Aaron just got married.
Yeah, Aaron just got married. And I'm in Disney World.
We right love now. Taylor in Disney World.
Yeah, so that's my bright and shiny.
I'm sure you're having fun.
I am probably having the time of my life. Can't wait.
Love it for you.
Yeah. So thanks for listening. If you have a story you want to send in, you can do that at alittlebitgrim@gmail.com, or you can visit the website.
Check out the candle. Follow us on the social meds.
Do the things. If you wanted to leave us a review, you could do that.
It's so helpful.
Apple Podcast or Podchaser.
And we are almost ready to make a big announcement.
Oh, yeah. Another one.
Another one. We have two. We told you. We have been cooking and a scheming.
Plotting.
And do all kinds of dastardly
things.
And we have another huge announcement.
Are we going to announce that in like 2 days? What day were we planning on announcing that? Like September 15th?
Yeah.
Wait, that was 2 days ago. Because this is going to come out on September 17th. We'll announce it. We'll let you know about it.
I'm going.
No, you're not. We have so much to do.
My butt's wet.
Things. I'm so sorry.
It's okay. Anyway, keep your eye out. There's lots of things moving and shaking. We love you. Be kind to yourself.
And to others. I forgot.
Bye.
Yeah, let's do it again. Do the whole thing again. We'll start from
the whole episode.
Yeah, the whole episode again. Be kind to yourself.
And others.